Good evening, folks. It's Brent Holland from Night Fright. You're listening to CKLU.ca 96.7 FM. Tonight, the JFK conspiracy. The JFK conspiracy is the biggest conspiracy in history, the consequences of which are still resounding to today. But was it just one lone nut assassin, Lee Harvey Oswald? Was there more than one shooter in Daley Plaza that day? Was there indeed a shot from the front and from the infamous grassy knoll? Since 1963, forensic investigation techniques have evolved, and technology has become more advanced in a wide variety of fields. Tonight, live from Dallas, the heart of it all, senior crime scene investigator Sherry Feister is here. She has the research, she has the science, she has the facts. What she has found will blow you away. Tonight, it's the JFK assassination on Night Fright. Oh, and one more thing. All the rumors you have ever heard about the assassination are true. Strap in and hang on. Here we go.
There is a time to question. There is a time for answers. There is a time to challenge. There is a time to speculate. There is a time for change. There is a time for truth. The time is now. Welcome to Night Fright, your voice in the dark. For Paranormal and Conspiracy Radio. And now your host, Brent Holland.
Good evening. I'm pleased to welcome to Night Fright for the very first time, live on the phone all the way from Dallas, Texas, senior crime scene investigator Sherry Feister. Sherry, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
Oh, you're very welcome. Thank you for being here. It's a long way from Dallas to Sudbury.
Yes, it is.
How are you this evening?
I'm doing fine, thank you. Excited to be on the show and to have an opportunity to speak to maybe a new group of people, people that are not familiar with my organization and the things that we found.
Just let me give the JFK Lancer website URL out. It's www.jfk.com. LANCER.com. And why it's called JFK Lancer is because the name Lancer was actually given to JFK as a code name by the Secret Service, and his wife's, the First Lady Jacqueline Kennedy's code name was Lace. So it was Lancer and Lace. So right now we're speaking with Sherry Feister. You're listening to CKLU 96.7. And Sherry, let's jump right in and perhaps give folks a little bit of a background, why you became a crime scene investigator, and everybody's seen the shows, I'm sure, on television now, how the science worked its way into the assassination as of late, due strictly to your own investigation and your own initiatives.
Well, I wish that I could say that I grew up wanting to be in police work or forensic work, but it really didn't happen that way. I kind of backed into it. I was looking for a job, and someone that I knew very well and worked for a sheriff's department said, you would be a great police officer. You should apply. Well, at the time, they had no women working on the force except as dispatchers and in clerical positions. However, I did apply, and surprisingly, I found myself one of the first women on the streets of this community in Louisiana. And after about 3 years, they had an opening in the forensic unit, and they came to me and said, we would like for you to do this. Well, the forensic unit...
Sherry, can I just ask you around what, sure, what era was this?
1980s, very early 80s.
You see that people forget that women weren't in positions like this and as early ago as 1980.
Right. And really at that time, say you had a forensic unit was something that was very rare.
Mm-hmm.
And as a result, the agency that I worked for had developed a very highly sophisticated team, and we helped and assisted with investigations in eight parishes because it was so rare. And they asked me to become a member of this team, and ultimately I said yes. At first I said, no, I don't want to do anything with a dead body, you know. I don't want to do that. I just couldn't imagine how that could be good for me. And I turned it down. And they came back again, and this time they brought a book with them about forensics and said, don't tell us no until you've read this book. And I had just barely gotten into the book, and I realized I would love to do this. So I decided I could handle the gruesome scenes and went ahead and accepted the position. And I was very lucky because I worked for an agency that believed in training, and they sent me to an unbelievable amount of schools. And so I found myself slowly becoming a forensic investigator. And so I did that for 20 years, over 20 years. I investigated crime scenes, homicides predominantly.
It must have been pretty gory for you to do that.
You know, everybody says, oh, you get used to it. It's like a doctor gets used to looking at blood and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
I think you adjust and become accustomed to looking at the scene and the grisly part of the scene. But I don't think anyone ever really becomes accustomed to seeing the human suffering.
Mm.
No, I don't think you ever adjust to that.
That's a very good point, actually, you bring up. People forget
right.
about that. It's not
right.
just the body. It's the people who are left afterwards.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's a demanding field. But it was very rewarding in that I knew that if I did my job well,
mm-hmm.
I would take someone off the street and maybe prevent something horrible happening to another family.
That's really admirable. I have to admire you for doing that.
Well, thank you. I liked it.
What led you to the JFK assassination of all things?
Oh, my goodness. Well, as I was investigating and testifying as a forensic investigator,
mm-hmm.
my sister, Deborah Conway, and she is president and founder of JFK Lancer Publications and Productions, she was investigating the John F. Kennedy assassination. She, as long as I can remember, has been interested in the Kennedy family, in his politics, his administration, and in the investigation. And for years, she would say, please look at this case. And I would say to her, there is nothing that I can add to what has not been done. I'm sure that people that are a lot more experienced than me have looked at it a lot longer, and there's nothing for me to do.
Mm-hmm.
And I literally would just brush it off. You know, I too love the Kennedys, but Robert Kennedy was the Kennedy that I was infatuated with.
Uh-huh.
He would have been the first man that I could have voted in an election.
Oh.
It would have been his presidency. So it was a very important time in my life, and I was more focused on him. And so I think I, on his death, got caught up, you know, in the times and
mm-hmm.
lost my interest so much in the Kennedy assassination and in him. And for all those years, I was doing something that no one had ever done with the Kennedy assassination. I was reconstructing crime scenes and applying current forensic techniques to crimes that were occurring. And I mistakenly thought that others had done that with the Kennedy assassination and was very surprised to find out that I was wrong.
Why do you think nobody had looked into it before yourself?
Well, I say that I was wrong and that no one had looked into it.
Mm-hmm.
Once I came forward, I had other people come to me privately and say, you know, we did this, and I know that you're right, but why are you doing this? It is just a political killer.
Mm.
You know, don't associate yourself with these nuts. That's what they said. You know, and so, you know, it was like two sides of a coin. On one side, the professional side is, I'm above this and don't want to become involved, and I'm not going to go out on a limb and be the first one to say this.
Mm-hmm.
But in their private lives, they knew what the truth was. But because they weren't speaking openly about it, I didn't realize that they felt like that. So someone had publicly come forward and made themselves a part of the Kennedy assassination research.
It was kind of validation for you on one hand, but on the other hand, nobody would publicly come forward, so it was kind of a slap in the face.
The only thing that they would do is that many, many people were willing to peer review my work. And so by having peers review your work and say, I can find nothing wrong with your techniques, I can find nothing wrong with your findings, that in a way is saying I agree with you and, you know, with what you're saying and what you're publishing.
I was just going to say, Sherry, for those of you that are in university doing a PhD and you're doing papers and things for publication for peer review, this is the same thing. I'm trying to build an analogy so people understand what you've gone through and the fact that nobody had anything negative to say about your findings.
It really was validation.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk a little bit about those crime scene investigation techniques that you decided to use and how you applied them to the Kennedy assassination.
The first thing that I did was dealing with bloodstain pattern analysis. I believe it was a Thanksgiving in 1992, maybe. I was in the kitchen washing the dishes, and my sister Deborah was looking at a book that had a photograph of the Zapruder frames in it, and she was talking about someone else with it, talking about the photograph with someone in my family, and said something about this blood that you could see out in the air. And since I was an expert, a court-certified expert in blood stain pattern analysis, this immediately caught my ear. So I just kind of walked over and to the table and looked over her shoulder and said, oh, that's backspatter. And she said, what's backspatter?
Mm-hmm.
I said, that's blood that's expelled out of an entry wound back towards the shooter. I thought my little sister was going to fly. She was so excited. Just was so excited. And, you know, she starts asking me all of these questions. And for people that work with Deborah at JFK Lancer, they know she can get anything done. I mean, absolutely anything. She has contacts that you would never dream of.
Yeah, she's
right
a fireball.
After that, just absolutely a fireball.
Mm-hmm.
The next thing I know, I'm slated to speak at a conference in Washington, D.C. in a few months. You're gone. You have to have this paper ready. They want a synopsis, and you know, you have to give up. I'm like, oh my heavens, what have I done? Well,
wow,
when time, you know, really when it came time to present in Washington, it was the very first time that anyone spoke out on bloodstain pattern analysis or used any kind of forensic investigative technique to determine if the fatal headshot came from the front or the rear. And I was actually sequestered in a homicide case and had to get special permission to go. But go I did, and I was in Washington, D.C., and I don't know how many hundreds of people are in this conference room, auditorium. And I give them, you know, the information that they needed just as if they would be a jury and I was testifying at a trial, because for me, that's what I did. This was a homicide. I applied forensic techniques that I did every day, and I presented that information to a jury for them to make up their mind as to what occurred. It was just stunning. It was just, they were so excited to hear something new and so accepting that it was a possibility.
Well, I think more than a possibility, because there's science. There's solid science that you have used in other investigations that you just brought to this one. So the template was already there. And the results you found were, well, they blew me away. I was stunned. I was absolutely stunned. Absolutely. I wasn't expecting the results that you had. I really wasn't. And we'll get to those after, folks.
Okay.
we're speaking with Sherry Feister right now. Am I pronouncing your last name correctly?
Actually, it is Feister.
Feister, but, I apologize.
Yeah, that's okay. It's not a problem.
It's my Canadian accent.
There you go.
And you're listening to CKLU 96.7 FM in Sudbury, and we are now streaming on the internet, www.cklu.ca. Just hit the streaming link, and you'll be up and running listening to us anywhere in the world. And Sherry is a senior crime scene investigator She's brought forward techniques that she has learned by being a CSI and has applied them to the JFK assassination, and we were discussing her result and her techniques. Before we do, I should just say you had mentioned the Zapruder film before, and for folks that don't know, the Zapruder film was shot by a fellow by the name of Abraham Zapruder. And Abraham Zapruder was just in front of the grassy knoll shooting the motorcade as JFK went by. And just do a Google real quick on the Zapruder film. And I'm sure you've all seen it before. It was in the JFK movie by Oliver Stone. It's the most common film that you've probably seen of the JFK assassination. I think it lasts about 23 seconds. And each frame of the Zapruder film was given a number. And the actual headshot was Zapruder 313 or Z313. So with that as a background, I guess we'll move on to some more of your techniques, if you don't mind sharing.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
Well, once I had presented the bloodstain pattern analysis at several conferences, I retired from police work and found myself with more time on my hands than I was used to. And I was just looking for something to occupy my time, basically. But, of course, Deborah was always after me to speak at a conference or do something new. And so I thought, you know, if I were really reconstructing this crime scene, the next thing that I would undertake would be a trajectory analysis to determine where the shooter was. You know? And I did that. And I called her up on the phone and said, I have something really interesting to tell you. I don't think that the shooter was standing on the grassy knoll. And she said, Sherry, you know you're wrong. For 30 years, people have looked at this. There's no way that they were wrong. Mm-hmm. You know, no one has suggested that it's not from the grassy knoll unless you are, you know, a fan of the Warren Commission. And you're just wrong. And I kept on to say, no. I'm using trigonometry.
Trigonometry
is not confused. It is not have a memory problem. You know,
it's not bias.
That's it.
Yeah.
It's not. And this is what it shows. And so she was pretty excited about that and then asked me to do another presentation for her. And so in 2003, I presented the trajectory analysis at the November in Dallas conference that is hosted each year by JFK Lancer on the anniversary of the assassination.
Can you talk about that conference? I know there's another one coming up between the 21st and 23rd. Would you mind giving a bit of the history of it and
Absolutely.
Where people can go to sign up for it?
Sure. Okay, if you go to jfklancer.com, there is an opportunity when you're looking at it to look at conferences, and if you go to the conferences, it will tell you the conference that's being held at that time, and you can also look and see what conferences were held in the past. So you can see the schedule, the speakers that are going to be there, and this year is just an outstanding array of people that are speaking.
There sure
and
is.
A lot of, I mean, it is really good, because this is the 45th anniversary of the conference. We asked for some very special people to come, and we are just very, very excited. You are going to see some new things. I don't present very often. I think that it's been maybe 4 years, or at least maybe a little more. Maybe it was 2003 when I spoke there. The Lancer conferences basically... because JFK Lancer is a historical research company, they specialize in the administration and assassination of President Kennedy. They pull together the renowned researchers from all over the world and provide a platform for them to share their work with people, whether it's through publishing their books, helping them to obtain information for their books, or to speak at the conferences. And at the conferences, they apply to come. We select those people each year out of a large group that asks to be speakers, and we put them in groups that are similar so that there is a continuity to the program. And we let them talk. Most of the time, they're talking about the assassination. However, we do look at the policies in the administration of JFK as they relate to the assassination. Each year when we have that conference, it's called November in Dallas. We have the speakers on DVD mm-hmm. from past conferences, which can be purchased at jfklancer.com. And we also have a memorial service at Dealey Plaza. And this year it will be on the anniversary day. And we have a wonderful host of people that are going to be presenting some very special music and messages at that time.
It sounds like a very special event coming up.
It is very special. Mm-hmm. And we also give scholarships, which very few people know about. We help people that are trying to go to college, and we help teachers. We give cash scholarships in adjacent to books and research material to those teachers who use the JFK Kennedy assassination in the classroom, no matter what they're teaching, whether they're using it for history or critical thinking. Mm-hmm. It doesn't matter. We give them money for use in the classroom to help them to be able to do that.
It's fantastic.
And we also have scholarships for students. They apply online. There's a way that they can click on scholarships, and through that link they can learn what they need to do and how to apply. They write their, it's like a paper that they would write about what the JFK assassination means to them or why we should study it. And they present that to us, and we mm-hmm. select a student each year to receive a cash scholarship to help them get to college.
Mm-hmm.
So, mm-hmm. you know, Lancer is not just about the big name people having a place to speak and getting their books published. It's also for people that want to write it from paper, and they just need some information. So
it's a fantastic resource, I have to admit. Many, many times I've been to the website. There's even a forum you could sign up for and join in conversations. I understand that you have a DVD for sale at Lancer with all the information and your research completed on it.
Yes, I do. It's the forensic DVD, mm-hmm. and it has four programs on it.
Oh, it has four on it. Oh, okay.
Yes. Yeah. I did an analysis on the blood stain pattern.
That's right.
Work on the fatal headshot.
Trajectory.
I also did a second one on the trajectory.
Mm-hmm.
I did a crime scene critique of the crime scene work that was done in the school book depository.
Oh.
It's based upon uh-huh. the crime scene standards of 1963 and upon the written standards for the Dallas City Police Department.
Oh, we'll have to get into that for sure.
And the fourth presentation mm-hmm. deals with trajectory analysis on the shooting death of J.D. Tippit.
J.D. Tippit, I should explain to folks, it's reputed that as Oswald was making his way, escaping, if you will, from the Texas School Book Depository, sometime after the shooting, he ran into a police officer and allegedly killed the police officer, and that police officer's name was J.D. Tippit. That was the reason given for arresting Oswald in the first place. He was not originally charged with murdering the president. That only came afterwards. The original charge against Oswald was the murder of this police officer. Some researchers don't believe that he actually was involved in that shooting either, and it was another frame-up. Let's go back and talk a little bit about the blood splatter and the trajectory analysis that you did, and maybe some of the techniques. I know there's 5 steps for trajectory analysis. I wonder if we could just walk through those 5 steps.
There are a lot of people that believe that Oswald was the shooter
mm-hmm.
from the school book depository. And there are a lot of people that believe that the fatal shot from the grassy knoll came from the grassy knoll.
Mm-hmm.
If you really want to know where the fatal headshot came from, then you have to do a trajectory analysis.
Mm-hmm.
It's not enough to just say, this is what I think. And in the clip that you played mm-hmm. from the movie JFK,
mm-hmm.
it's so interesting that you picked a portion of the movie where he says, back and to the left.
I did that on purpose.
Back and to the left.
Mm-hmm.
I thought for so many years, back and to the left. Well, common sense is going to tell me, in my experience as a police officer or an investigator, tells me that back and to the left, I know it's a frontal headshot.
Mm.
But yet I waited for a long time to to prove it forensically. And then once I did that, I've always said the shot came from the right front. The problem is, where is the right front?
Mm-hmm.
What is the right front? I mean, it's one thing to say from the right front, but if you don't really know what the right front is, it could be anywhere.
Exactly. Very good point. And I should also mention that the Warren Commission, just as a little bit of a history background to this, the Warren Commission was assigned in the same sense that the 9/11 Commission was assigned to investigate the tragedies. And the Warren Commission was the commission that was assigned to investigate the JFK assassination. And their conclusion was a shot from the back from the Texas School Book Depository, which was behind JFK, by one single shooter. And that shooter was Lee Oswald. Alice in Wonderland, as they call it. Once you're down that hallway, holy cow. All that to say is, if there is, in fact, a shooter from the front, then by definition, there was two shooters and a conspiracy. And that's what we're going to get into tonight. And Sherry's got the facts and the science to prove it, which is incredible, incredible work. All you folks from Lancer and all the researchers in general, and I have to give you kudos, because nobody's making a dime off this. This is all research on your own time, your own initiatives also. If you make a few bucks, it's not much. It's not like you're all Stephen King's when you write a book and you make millions off them. You know, if you break even, you're lucky. And as a musician, I know what that's all about. Trust me. You know, you release a CD and you hope you can cover your printing costs.
I do want to say that since you brought up the thing about money, you know, you're absolutely right. I do not know of any researcher that either began this work or continued their work because they wanted to make money.
That's right.
Because you do not make money doing research.
That's right.
It really isn't. Mm-hmm. I'm going to tell you, there is a reason that they do this. And I guess the reason for all of us is pretty much the same. You know, I want to go back to, I guess, a quote of President Kennedy's to help explain that. President Kennedy once said, "For the great enemy of truth is very often not the lie, deliberate, contrived, and dishonest, but the myth, persistent, persuasive, and unrealistic." And that is what happened for so many years. There was a myth that the Warren Commission wanted people to believe. It was persistent, it was persuasive, but it was unrealistic.
Mm-hmm.
And because it was, you know, people had to know the truth. And for so many years, the people that struggled to find the truth were just laughed at. They were called conspiracy buffs. As if this was a joke.
Almost as if they were lunatics or something for even believing such
a
thing.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
It's just like the people that I worked with said, "Are you nuts to do this?"
Mm.
You know? But people that are in research are seekers of the truth. They are like soldiers in a war, and they are not winning in a material way.
At all.
I mean, war is hard.
That's right.
And it takes its toll. It demands a lot of you.
Mm-hmm.
And all of those people that have done so many things, and I mean, you just spoke with Mary Hancock,
mm-hmm.
she's an excellent, excellent example.
Fantastic.
And my sister Deborah Conway is another example.
There you go.
She is unbelievable in her commitment and dedication to revealing the truth as it relates to President Kennedy and his assassination. And thankfully, because of her struggle to do so and her commitment to do so, and when I say commitment, I mean a full commitment, the truth is being revealed. And that is the satisfaction that these researchers get from it.
In my opinion, it's love of country, but it goes beyond patriotism. It's love of freedom itself and that precious gem we all hold dearly of freedom.
You know, it really is. It really does come down to something like that. Almost to an individual when you speak to someone who's been doing this for many years. It is just an ingrained in them that the truth would be known. And so that's what they're doing. So when you purchase something from JFK Lancer, or if you attend the November in Dallas conferences, believe me, every penny that is spent goes right back into research.
That's
There's
right.
no one benefiting financially. There really isn't.
Yeah, there's no private jets there, folks.
No, my goodness.
As Sherry has been saying, it is the 45th anniversary of the JFK assassination. And tonight we are lucky to have Sherry Feaster. She is a crime scene investigator, senior crime scene investigator. She's on the phone all the way from Dallas, Texas, where it took place. And we're discussing the JFK assassination and her crime scene investigation techniques that have shown a frontal shot, but surprisingly, not from the grassy knoll, which everybody believes the fatal headshot came from. And there are five steps for trajectory analysis, and we were just discussing them. The first one being determine the approximate location of the entry and exit wounds. I was wondering if we could take them step by step and go through them. Would that be okay, yes, Sherry?
Absolutely, we can.
Thank you.
I want to say to your readers, your listeners, if you want to try to do this with us, if you have a pen and paper, and if you have access to a map of Dealey Plaza, I can kind of walk you through a very, very basic trajectory analysis so that you can see how this works for yourself.
I recommend to everybody just do a quick Google on Dealey Plaza map and you'll see something. If you're driving in the car, don't do it.
right.
Just imagine an upside down L. And that'll give you a pretty good indication of how Dealey Plaza would be laid out.
In order to do the trajectory, first let me say that a trajectory is the path that a bullet would travel through space.
Mm-hmm.
And a bullet in three dimensions is not only going forward, but it's always also going to be have elevation changes. But when you have a high-speed bullet traveling a short distance, like it would in Dealey Plaza, that curvature would be very slight. So you can use a straight line trajectory in this particular analysis and have it be just almost right on. It'd be very, very accurate, very accurate. So what you need to do is determine what those two points are.
Mm-hmm.
What two points would you use? Well, normally if you have two points that you know the bullet has gone through, they're going to be an entry and an exit wound. So that's what we would use for the JFK shooting.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to select the entry and exit wounds, and that would determine the beginning of our trajectory. Now, in order to do that, we have to decide where the wounds are, and there is quite a bit of controversy about that. So it would be hard for us to say this particular point is where the bullet impacted the head.
Okay. So I'm going to do this along with you. I've got my upside down L all set to go.
All right, you got your L. Okay. What I'd like for you to do is to draw an oval as if you were looking down on a skull, down on someone's head.
A top view of the skull. Okay.
All right, so you just make an oval and you say, I'm looking down on someone's head.
Okay.
And you're going to divide the head so that it's into four pieces. So you would draw a line across the center and down the center. So you would divide that oval into four even pieces.
Okay.
Done. All right?
Okay. Looks
and
like a
then
piece of pie.
On one side, on either the top or the bottom, and I would probably use the top because it's the easiest,
Okay. Draw
on that line that's going intersecting vertically. Draw a little arrow at the top, and you're going to know that's the way that the skull is facing. He's looking that way.
I see.
His nose would be on that side.
Okay.
So on the right-hand side, on that top portion, would be the right front quadrant.
Okay.
That would be the right front quadrant. And directly below that would be the rear right quadrant.
So RRQ, I'm going to initial it for rear right quadrant. Okay.
Okay. What we do know about the entry and the exit is that it happened in those two portions of the head. All of the injuries to President Kennedy's head are on the right side. And all of the medical witnesses agree to that.
Mm-hmm.
So that is testimony, statement, photographic, and video documentation. Pretty much all the research information that you would want to see concerning that can be found on either jfkanswer.com or maryferrell.org. so that you can see all of this information. Now, the medical evidence is talked about in a lot of the testimony, including the Warren Commission and then the House Select Committee, and you know, there's lots of other places. But to give you a few examples of where they say the head wounds are, the first one I'm going to talk about is Dr. Charles Crenshaw. He was at Parkland Hospital.
We should explain what Parkland Hospital is to the folks that aren't familiar with that. Parkland Hospital, once JFK was shot, he was rushed to a hospital, and that hospital happened to be Parkland Hospital, which was about 2 or 3 kilometers away, something like that?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. Yeah.
Dr. Crenshaw testified that the head wound was right behind the ear in the occipital parietal region, or the right rear quadrant of the head. That's his testimony. His words, right rear quadrant.
Okay.
Okay? Now, if you want to know where these bones are, the parietal bone is at the top and the sides of the skull, and the occipital bone is in the back lower part of the skull. And if you wanted to do this on yourself to see, if you put your fingertips together and you put your hands like the palms over your ear and your fingers were together on the top of your head, then you are pretty much defining the parietal region of the head.
I'm doing that as you speak.
Now, if you reach back with your thumb kind of right in the center, you feel like there's a little ridge or a bump
right in
the back. Like if you were going to rest your head against something, that's the part that would touch. Right there is the beginning of the next part, and that's the occipital. So if you took your hand and put it, if you took your right hand and you put your thumb right at the base of your neck, then your hand is, your palm of your hand is pretty much showing the occipital portion.
That's really clear. Thank you, Sherry. That's great.
So other people also had the same observations. Dr. William Kemp, Clark Kemp, at Parkland, he was actually the chairman of the neurosurgery. So I would think he is experienced.
I would think, yeah.
He said, there is a large wound beginning in the right occipital, which would be the bottom part, extending into the parietal region. So in other words, he said it's kind of low, but coming up on the back of the head. Okay? And the same thing is said by a lot of the people that were at Parkland. But they also had people at Bethesda that made observations. And Bethesda Hospital is where the president's body was taken when it left Dallas so that they could perform the autopsy.
Okay.
All right. Now, this is James Hume was the chief autopsy pathologist, and he reported, and I'm quoting, there's a large, irregular defect of the scalp and skull on the right, involving chiefly the parietal bone, but extending somewhat into the temporal and occipital regions. Temporal means like what's behind your ear. So what he's saying is that it's in the back, and it's kind of over to the right-hand side and up a little bit, but it's a big area. And even,
No problem.
Another pathologist, Robert Carney, said most of the bone that was missing was destroyed in the back of the head. So there's a lot of people that are saying the exact same thing. And they're all describing this big defect that's to the back of the head.
And they're all professional doctors, well-versed
in... That's right. They are. So when you look at the injuries that are talked about, that is going to be a major injury. So we know that there are a lot of people that say that the right rear quadrant had an injury site, but they're not talking about a point. They're talking about a large area. So in order for us to get 2 points, they're not going to be little pinpoints. They're going to be areas instead.
Okay.
So what we're going to do is we're going to say that entire rear area is now 1 point.
Okay, I'm putting lines through it kind of like a grid.
Okay.
Just so we know that that's the area.
So that's 1 point.
Okay.
So we need another point. All right. If you have ever looked at the Zapruder film or a frame from the Zapruder film, you can plainly see what looks like a pink blob.
That's right.
Or there's something. Sometimes it appears to be white. That's in front of his ear on the right side of his head. It's towards the front of his face, of his head. And you can see the ear behind it. So you know that it's more or less in front. And people talk about that white blob. And they refer to it. Now we, what that is something that I have seen in life before many times in gunshot wounds to the head. And it's called a bone flap. Actually, they call it bone flap, but it's an avulsion, and an avulsion can be a tissue avulsion also. If you have something that creates an open wound and it's just barely connected, so it can kind of flap around, or you know what I'm saying, it can open and close, then that's what has happened here, and that's in the front right quadrant.
Okay.
So that whole quadrant becomes the second point that the bullet went through.
Okay.
So you really got these two big sections. Now, it's very important because we have this front part that has the bone flap. You know, I don't call it, I call it a flap because that's what I see other people that are not medically trained call it.
Yeah, it's
so
probably
I'm
what I would call it too. Yeah, unfortunately, as a layperson.
Right, and so I want to make it as easy for everyone to understand about this bone flap.
Okay.
The bone flap, or the avulsed bone, is actually bone that has been broken away from the skull because of the damage to the skull, but it's still attached because it's attached to the scalp, and the scalp is not broken away, so it's just kind of hanging there.
Okay? Yeah.
So in order to know that that's what it is and to be able to say with some confidence that it's a bone flap, and that is another separate wound from what the doctors have described, you have to cover two points. Number one, why did they talk about it? Okay. Secondly, how does that happen? Why would they have that flap? We need to know those two things because they're very important.
Sherry, just let me tell people who we're speaking with that are just joining us. Folks, you are indeed listening to CKLU 96.7 FM here in Sudbury. And we are now streaming CKLU.ca. Just hit the streaming link and you're up and running. More importantly, you're listening to Night Fright and we're discussing the headshot of JFK. Sherry's taking us through a little bit of an exercise and a terrific one so far. I'm more clear on the headshot than I have ever been in my life. Let's just continue with that then.
Okay, so first let me tell you what the doctor said about this bone flap or this avulsed bone. Robert McClellan from Parkland Hospital, he was actually an instructor in surgery. So he's an instructor, and he says the parietal bone, and remember that's the one that if you put your hands together on the top of your head, that plate of bone was laid outward to the side. The right temporal, remember I said that was underneath, more or less underneath the ear and behind the ear.
That's right.
The right temporal and the occipital bones were missing. So what he's saying is we have a piece of bone that's come undone at the top and it's hinged down
on the
right side. And in the back, we have a hole at the back bottom part of the head. That's what he's saying.
Sherry, what happened to the bone in the back of the head? Now, we know the other one's flapped down, but what happened to the bone in the back of the head? Did that just disintegrate?
Well, some of it was thrown out and recovered as a Harper fragment.
I see. That was the fragment that was found afterwards in Daly Plaza. Yes.
Right. And then a portion of it was collected from by Jackie Kennedy on the back of the limo.
That's right.
And given to the doctors at Parkland.
Just to relay that story, folks, if you have seen the Zapruder film, you'll see Jackie Kennedy jumping out of the back seat and onto the trunk of the limo. And many people for many years thought that she was trying to get away from the traumatic event, the gunshots to be specific. But in fact, she was trying to grasp a piece of JFK's head, her husband's head, and did in fact grasp it and put it back on his head and virtually tried to hold his brains in. Just horrible. Just horrible.
Yes. Now, Malcolm Perry, who was the assistant professor there, said at Parkland, said, a large, evolved wound of the right parietal occipital area, both scalp and portions of the skull were absent. Okay? So the flap was well documented. The problem was when the layperson reads some of this stuff and they have no firsthand experience in looking at it, it's hard for them to envision what the doctors are talking about.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? So the flap was there. It was seen in the Zapruder film, and on the ride to Parkland, Mrs. Kennedy, as you said, attempted to put that back. She wanted to close that wound.
Mm-hmm.
So she closes it back, and blood is very sticky, and it kind of dried there so that wound stayed closed, but the back open wound was readily seen. Later, Jackie Kennedy told Theodore White, and he wrote about it. He wrote, she remembered, as I sat paralyzed, the pink rose ridges on the inside of the skull and how from here on down, and she made a gesture from above her forehead. He was so beautiful. I tried to hold the top of his head down. Mm. Maybe I could keep it in, but I knew he was dead. And you can even see this a flap in some of the autopsy photographs.
That's right. Yeah, I've seen those photos too. Yeah.
Okay. Mm. So we know that they had that flap there. And the flap was caused from a bullet, and flaps are created most of the time adjacent to the impact site. You don't see flaps in the back of the head where the flaps are normally associated with entry sites.
Okay, I didn't know that. That's incredible.
Right. So you have, to get a flap, what happens is you kind of need an understanding about how the bullet worked when it hit the skull.
Mm-hmm.
On my forensic DVD, there's like a little movie, and you can see all of these things that I'm talking about broken down into little steps, little gifts that you can stop and study so that you'll have a clear understanding. But the bullet interacts with the head in different stages. To us, it appears to be instantaneous, but it's actually a series of events that are taking place.
Mm-hmm.
First, the bullet strikes the skull, and it forms a small entry hole.
Okay.
Then the next thing that happens is the bullet starts to pass into the brain, cavitation part, and blood and brain matter is going to be ejected out of that hole, just ejected backwards out of that hole, that small hole, as backscatter. And that's what you see in frame 313 in the Zapruder film.
That's what that is. Okay, now I understand.
Yeah. Hey, I talked to Bill Newman, who was the man that was standing the closest to the president in front of him when the shooting occurred. He described that to me like a red mist. He said it was as if someone took a red spray paint of tan and just went, shh, and this red mist came out. And that's exactly what it looks like.
Precisely
exactly
what it looks like. Yes. Yeah.
So first you have that happen, and then you have the bullet that's now traveling through the brain, and it's going to start to expand. It might fragment, which it did in this case. It might start to just tumble. As it's doing that, it's creating two different kind of cavities. One is called a permanent cavity, and that's a permanent hole where the actual bullet passes, and it like creates a hole that's not going to close up. And then it has a temporary expanding cavity. And as that expands, that creates pressure inside the head that's enclosed, except for that little tiny hole.
So it's like an inner tunnel. Folks, if you can imagine this, it's a mining town. Of course, you can imagine the tunnels. So it's a tunnel, folks. And outside the tunnel, where all the pressure is, that's where you get the fall of ground and rock falls. So, yeah, there you go. Mining technology. Who knew?
Now I'm on the other end of that. Okay.
No, but it makes perfect sense what you're saying. You're doing a fantastic job. I can't say enough because you're guiding us through this very visceral thing. It's on the radio, and yet I'm picturing this exactly as you're describing it. You're doing a great job. That's all I can tell you.
Thank you. So as the bullet first struck the head, it starts to fracture the skull. And so you can imagine, beginning from where the wound is, going backwards, you get these little lines and fractures of the skull. Imagine it's like an egg that has suddenly been cracked.
Great analogy. Yes.
Okay?
Okay.
So you have this little cracked egg, and inside the cracked egg is the bullet. And the bullet is creating pressure that's pushing outward, and that's helping to crack the egg.
Okay.
Then the bullet continues forward, and because it, moving with the bullet and also slightly in front of the bullet is that pressure, it pushes out a greater hole. So a greater hole is exiting than what came in.
Uh-huh.
So that's why people say entry wounds are normally smaller than exit wounds.
Mm-hmm.
Okay?
Very clear.
All right. So you have this blood being expelled as backscatter that looks like a mist in the very beginning.
Mm-hmm.
But then when you have this new, bigger opening that's formed in the back, and you have the momentum of all this force picking up the blood and tissue, then a large amount of blood and tissue comes out of the back, and that's called forward scatter because it's going forward with the direction of the force. And that blood is going in every possible direction, and it gets on Bobby Hargis, and it gets on the Secret Service car behind them.
Mm-hmm.
It gets on the Cheney, who is the motorcycle officer on the other side, and it goes all over the limousine.
I should say Bobby Hargis, picture the limousine on the driver's side at the back in the rear, just near the rear left tire. That's where Bobby Hargis was on his motorcycle. Sorry to interrupt you, Sherry.
That's okay. And Cheney is the motorcycle officer on the opposite side.
That's just
mirroring him.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So all of this blood that comes out that people talk about, in fact, I've heard people say it was like a bucket of blood. There was so much stuff that came out. It stunned them. Well, that's why more came out, because it's traveling out of a larger opening, which we've heard the doctors talk about, a big hole in the back of the head.
That's right.
And it has the force of all of that bullet with it. So all of that matter is being ejected out.
Now,
okay?
Sherry, can I just ask you a question? Would
sure.
the bullet actually exit along with all that matter, or would it fragment inside the head, or what would happen with the bullet? There's a better question.
I think it's a combination of those two things.
I see. Okay.
We have fragments in the car that are collected from this exit spatter.
Okay.
And we have fragments that are left in the head that are collected at autopsy.
Uh-huh.
Now, I know the first thing people are saying, well, if the bullets are coming out of the back of the head, how are they found in the car? Wouldn't you want to know that?
I would for sure, because they were found actually in front of Connolly, weren't they, if I'm not mistaken?
Yeah. Some of them were.
Governor Connolly was sat right in front of President Kennedy. It was four seats in the back. JFK on the passenger side in the very back. Beside him to his left in the very back was Jacqueline Kennedy, and just in front was Jacqueline Kennedy was Mrs. Connolly, Governor Connolly's wife. And in front of JFK, just sitting directly in front of him, was Governor Connolly. In the front seat on the right-hand side was Secret Service Agent Kellerman, and on the left side was Secret Service Agent Greer, and Greer was the driver. I hope that can orientate the limo for people just a little bit.
Yeah. That was great, yeah. When you think about where the hole is, in the back of the head. The problem is, we think that, or we may visualize that President Kennedy was looking straight ahead when he was shot, but he wasn't.
No, he wasn't. Yes, that's right.
Actually, he's leaning forward, and if you put your hand on the back of your head, like if you put your the outside edge of one of your palm on that little bump, remember we talked about that bump?
Yeah, that's what I'm doing
right now. And then you go up. If you put your hand, the bottom portion of your palm is at that little bump, and then you tilt your head so that your fingers are headed straight up, that's pretty much the position that his head is in. His head is tilted down.
That's right, yeah. You can see that very clearly in the Zapruder film also.
Absolutely, you can.
Yeah.
You can see that. So because his head was tilted down, when the matter came out, it goes out in every possible direction. It doesn't go out like a stream. It goes out in a very, very wide cone.
Uh-huh.
So as a result, if the pole is at the top, it's going to go in a 360-degree angle circling that entry, that exit.
Okay.
Or entry or exit, because it does the same thing no matter which one you're looking at. But that's how spatter acts. The characteristic of spatter is that it travels in every conceivable direction. If you were to have projectiles or pieces of bone and tissue found in front of the president, then that is what you would expect to see because of the position of his head.
And, you know, that makes perfect sense, because I was reading William Law's book. William Law will be a guest here, actually, towards the end of the month, and we'll be discussing witnesses from the autopsy. He's got a lot to say, too. Agent Kellerman, I said before, was a Secret Service agent in the passenger side in the front seat, had bone splattered on him, and also the driver, Agent Greer, Secret Service Agent Greer, had stuff splattered on the back of him. And I was always confounded because I couldn't understand the correlation why the people driving behind him would be splattered and the people in front could be splattered at the same time. Now I know. You've made it crystal clear for me. Thank you.
Well, you're so welcome. And one of the other things that a lot of people are concerned about is, would bone really go that far? And when you think about that, pieces of bone and tissue were found on the Secret Service car windshield on the arm of the driver in the car behind them.
Mm-hmm.
And that is very consistent with how blood spatter reacts. And while I'm saying that, let me mention this. There are people that say, I don't believe that blood spatter is real. I think that was painted in. I think that the Zapruder film has been altered. There are people that believe that. But let me say this about that blood. Bloodstain pattern analysis as a field was not even known in 1963. It wasn't even known.
Ah.
In 1971, that is when the first study of bloodstain pattern analysis as it relates to high impact began to be studied. So law enforcement did not know about it. The general public did not know about it. You know, the CIA and the FBI did not know about it. The mob didn't know about it, and Cuba didn't know about it, and just pretty much anybody else that you want to say painted that in didn't know about it.
So that clarifies that aspect for me. Obviously, it's real blood spatter.
Yes, and you know that I have recreated, because I teach this, and of course I should say, I don't still teach it because I retired now, but when I was teaching it, I videotape it, and it takes the same length of time in the video that Zapruder made for that blood to be dispersed as it does when I am doing it on a shooting range and shooting into a bloody eye. Blood reacts in a very consistent, measurable, reproducible manner.
So there you have it, folks. We are speaking with Sherry Feaster, and she's from JFK Lancer Productions. JFK Lancer is an incredible resource made online. You can reach them at www.jfklancer.com. And the word Lancer comes from the code name that was given to John F. Kennedy by the Secret Service, which was Lancer. And the first lady, Jacqueline Kennedy, her code name was Lace. Just a wealth of resources there. They have a conference that's put on every year in November, right in Dallas, where all this took place. It's a Herculean effort that they all put on, and they invite different speakers, and it's just an incredible event. There will be a memorial service given right at Daly Plaza, and all that information can be found directly on jfklancer.com. Also, they shoot. I shouldn't use that word when associated with the assassination. They film.
There you go.
They film every conference in the same sense that Donald Scott was here. Professor Donald Scott was here at the end of August, and he had a conference. People were here filming that. And they put that up for sale on the website, and it's just an incredible resource of history right there. And we are so lucky to have Sherry, senior crime scene investigator, telling us all about how she's applied modern techniques. Everybody's seen the show CSI Miami and CSI New York and CSI, and how those techniques are put to use to solve crimes, and how she has used those same techniques and applied them to the JFK assassination. And right now we're discussing the headshot and trajectory locations.
I'm going to have to tell you that in order to use the entire quadrant Mm-hmm. If I use the entire quadrant as an entry and the bottom quadrant or the rear quadrant as an exit, it would require quite a bit of finesse in order for me to make you understand that over the radio.
Okay.
Because you're using trigonometry, you have to develop an angle that would encompass every possible trajectory. I do that in detail on my forensic DVD. But for our work tonight, mm-hmm. I want everyone listening that is doing this with us to pick a point on their right front quadrant that they think is the point that the bullet entered the head. So just pick a point that you think, and you would draw a dot there.
Okay. I've got it right over JFK's right eye, just a little bit to the right.
Okay. Mm-hmm. That's a good place. Then I'm going to pick a point in the back that I think that it might have come out of. And you can just arbitrarily pick the place that you think most likely would represent that. And remember, we're just a two-dimensional world here, so it's not really going to matter if you're thinking higher on the head or lower or whatever.
Again, the way I've marked it is on the right, but further towards the side of the head. In other words, not lining up exactly with my X that I've marked over JFK's right eye.
Okay.
More to the right of that.
Then what we would do, the next step, is draw a line that would intersect those two points, okay?
So you now have
a straight line trajectory,
uh-huh.
right? So you've
yes.
completed that first step. So you've mm-hmm. got your trajectory. And you have to determine, do you think it came from the front or the back along that trajectory? Because, you know, there's some people that are just entrenched in Oswald shot him.
Mm-hmm.
And you know what?
Mm-hmm.
If you are a believer that, well, Oswald shot him and you do not believe that it came from the front, you can still do the trajectory analysis. It'll just be backwards, okay?
Okay,
so
yeah.
Trajectory analysis is going to work regardless. You might be surprised that your shooter was not where you think he was, so, you know? So you might have to give up that rear shooter. You might have to give that up. So most people do believe that the shooter was from the front, if nothing else, because of the direction that the president fell, going back and to the left. I mean,
mm-hmm.
you know, if you strike a golf ball, it's going to go in the continued direction of travel. And so that's what has happened here. So once you've determined that, then you want to determine the target position. So that means we've got to place JFK in Dealey Plaza.
Mm-hmm.
And before we put him in there, I mean, we can know where he is. If you have, you talked about Dealey Plaza looking like a 7, right?
Close enough for rock and roll, yeah.
It's close enough to rock and roll.
Yeah.
You know, like maybe an upside down L. But let me just say, if you want to get a real good picture of what it looks like, if you draw a 7 with a straight line at the top, and then you know how some people make their curve go kind of down and to the left, it's kind of a fancy looking
mm-hmm.
7, or they make a 2 that has like a wand's neck that kind of curves in. Well, Dealey Plaza actually has that 7 or that swan curvy neck on the right. It has a straight line street, and then if you would mirror that 7,
mm-hmm.
so that 7 is going the other way, that's how Dealey Plaza looks. So
yeah,
you have
that's a
like
better
that.
Description than I gave, that's for sure. Thanks, Sherry.
Okay.
Okay.
So you would have like 2 swan necks that are, if you were looking at just the outside edges, it would be as if, you know, when you make an hourglass,
that's
you shape
right.
an hourglass with your hands. If you took the top part of the hourglass, that is Dealey Plaza. Just draw a line in the center, and now you have the 3 streets of Dealey Plaza.
There you
and
go.
And the little skinny net is where the triple underpass was.
I'm going to use that in the future. I hope you don't mind. I hope there's no copyright on that description.
You may borrow that.
Thank you very much.
When you talk about it, be sure that you talk about JFK answer.
I will. I'm going to plug it every show
Thank
this month.
Then on the left-hand side of that little hourglass,
mm-hmm.
there was a pergola. It was like a little semicircle area that ran parallel to the curved area. And on the bottom edge of that was a raised portion, a raised concrete portion where Zapruder stood. If you look at a map of Dealey Plaza and they show that little pergola, if you go straight out into the street at a 90-degree angle to where Zapruder was standing, you find the et where people have painted onto the street where Kennedy was located at the time of the headshot.
Okay.
So that's how you place your head within the plaza. The question is, which way is he looking? Because remember when we first started the show, mm-hmm. I said, I believe that he was shot from the right front. The question is, where is the right front?
Exactly. Very okay. good. Yes. Yeah.
So we have to know where he was looking. Well, there have been two people that have really done a profound study on placing the president. One was Thomas Canning, mm-hmm. and he was an engineer from NASA. He was on the Space Project Division of NASA,
mm-hmm.
and he was the one responsible for reconstructing Kennedy's head position for the Warren Commission. What we were talking about is the orientation of President Kennedy's head within Dealey Plaza.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so there are two people that did a study on this. One was Thomas Canning, who mm-hmm. was with NASA.
Yeah.
And the others was Dale Myers, and he did a computer recreation. And now Dale Myers is a person that believes that Oswald did this. But you know what? It's okay. His math is still good.
Okay.
So I'm going to, you know. And the other thing is that it coincides with Thomas Canning. And everyone else that's ever looked at this comes back and says, yeah, you know, these people knew what they were doing. So using these calculations, we can determine how his head was tilted down, how far away from Zapruder he was mm-hmm. also turned, and what the angle of his head was side to side, or the, you know, so you're looking at the pitch and the tilt and all of this stuff. And for our purposes, we don't need to worry about any of that except how was he looking? What direction was he looking?
Precisely, yeah.
And if you want to know the direction that he was looking, remember I said that we had like this little hourglass look. And on the right-hand side, mm-hmm. we have the street that's coming down. And on the right outside edge, where the concrete of the street meets the grass mm-hmm. and the overpass intersects the two, that is the point that JFK is looking. Okay?
Gotcha. So the opposite side of the grassy knoll.
So,
He's
looking away from the grassy knoll. Now, if you were in the limo, he would basically be looking out over the mirror that's found on the left-hand side of the vehicle
mm-hmm.
or out over the left front wheel. He's looking out not down the center of the limousine. He's looking off to the side, and because the limousine is in a curve, that even puts him more towards the other side.
Mm, good.
So,
yes, yes, yes.
So you take your little face head that you made, and remember mm-hmm. I said when you first divided the head, I said draw an arrow. That would be the way that that person would be facing.
That's right.
Line your head up so that your little head is in between those two positions.
I just did that. Okay.
All right?
Yeah.
So he's looking that way.
Okay.
Then, actually, he's looking a little further to the right, but I'm just going to use this as a point where people can visualize it in their mind.
That's okay? Perfect. That's fine. This is great.
It's just for visualization.
Mm-hmm.
And once you do that, then if you look at the line that you drew as a straight line trajectory,
that's right.
Mm-hmm. You can then see where you think the shooter was standing.
Oh my goodness me! Look at that, eh?
Uh-huh. Okay. So now you can say, I think the shooter was standing in this area right here, in order to make the entry and exit wounds in the places that I believe. Now, here's the interesting part and really important part.
Okay.
It's not only what is possible, but what is impossible.
Mm.
So, if I want to come in at the right front, the most extreme angle that I can take without moving my little head and keeping that skull in the right position and not intersect the left-hand side of the head,
mm-hmm.
that would be another straight line trajectory that I could draw on there. That angle that I just created, everything that's outside of that angle cannot be where the shooter was located.
That makes complete sense. Absolute
consent. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So not only are you saying that the shooter is on the opposite side of Dealey Plaza from Zapruder and the grassy knoll, but it was impossible for the shooter of the fatal headshot to be on the grassy knoll.
Wow.
It's mathematically impossible.
And it's funny, you know, because the House Select Committee, folks, if you're not sure what the House Select Committee is, I'll do a quick Reader's Digest version of it. Towards the late 70s, there was such a ruckus about the JFK assassination, the Martin Luther King assassination, and the Bobby Kennedy assassination, and wrongdoings by the CIA that the American Congress got together and decided to have an investigation on all three assassinations. And indeed, for the JFK assassination, the end result was a probable conspiracy based on analysis of a soundtrack. I won't go into detail. They had a soundtrack of possible shots from Dealey Plaza. And the result of that soundtrack was that there was indeed a shot from the grassy knoll, but it missed the limo. It coincides with what you're saying. I found that fascinating. Absolutely fascinating, you know, that... first of all, that there was scientific proof that there was indeed a frontal shot, which blows me away because right away that's conspiracy.
Right.
I just get goosebumps thinking of that. And why would the government cover it up? We'll get into that after. But to think that all these years, I believed it came from the grassy knoll, and it did not. It came from the opposite side of the grassy knoll where no one was looking.
Right.
Incredible work, Sherry.
Thank you.
You deserve a medal for this. This is incredible.
Well, I didn't get a medal, but I did get something, I have to tell you.
Please,
in 2003, at one of the JFK Lancer November in Dallas conferences, I was honored with the Mary Farrell JFK Lancer New Frontier Award in appreciation for my contributions to new evidence and furthering the study of the assassination. Thank you. Larry Hancock's also been awarded things, that same kind of thing, as many of the people, you know, that are big researchers. And I am just honored to be with that group of people. They have put in so many more years than I have and really done a lot. They really have. But yes, this is, I think it's groundbreaking work. And, you know, no one else has done this. And, when I speak at the November in Dallas conference this year, I am going to talk about this analysis in detail, and I am going to do a little bit more than the presentations that I've done in the past, which I think I've only maybe done one on the trajectory, maybe two. I doubt. I don't think so. I think just one. And I'm going to kind of clear up a few little things. There are some questions people have, like, well, would it get over the limo? And what about Jackie? Would it hit her? And, you know, things like that. I'm going to address all of those things. So this coming conference is going to have new stuff. It's, you know, I'm not just going to be saying the same thing that I've always said. And so if they're listening here and they think they're getting everything, they won't be.
I want to mention
there really are more things.
I want to mention your DVD, which is for sale at jfklancer.com, www.jfklancer.com. And all the information, folks, if you want to go to this conference, I highly recommend it. You will learn a lot more about the conspiracy. You're going to meet some great people, and there's going to be a great memorial going on. It's 45 years since...
You know what is wonderful about going to the conferences is that you not only get to meet people like Larry Hancock and William Law, and myself,
Feaster.
And you get to talk to us one-on-one and ask us questions and, you know, have books signed and that type of thing. But there are also some very important people there that the opportunity to meet is dwindling fast. People like Ed Hoffman.
Good point.
The deaf mute that saw a shooter from the grassy knoll. He saw that person. He saw what they did with the rifle. And there was always a problem because for him, American Sign Language is his language. English is a second language.
That's right.
And he does not, you know, he was not taught English. He picked up a little bit along the way. But he has found a wonderful interpreter and two people that are researchers and actually high school, one of them is a high school teacher, that have helped him write a book that is coming out this November, and he's going to be at the conference. Wow. And his story is going to be told in full with detail for the very first time. Another person that's going to be there that is not available, not going to be available forever, is someone like Aubrey Reich. Aubrey Reich mm-hmm. is the ambulance driver who was in the room with Jackie Kennedy when she came in, when the president was deceased, and tried to put her wedding ring on his hand.
Mm-hmm.
He is the person that put the president in the coffin.
Mm-hmm.
So he has a very unique story to tell. And people like the Mr. and Mrs. Bill Newman, who were right there when it happened, and Beverly Oliver, who they call the babushka lady that was in the Dealey Plaza, all of these people have such an experience to share, and they're at the conference and available for people to just speak with. They make themselves just available to anyone that wants to take a photograph or get their autograph and ask them for some personal related incidences. So it really is a fine conference, not only on the educational level, but it is enriching on a personal level.
It really is. And folks, if you were listening this afternoon, you do know that we had mentioned Aubrey Reich. I was speaking with Larry Hancock about it, to the fact that Aubrey Reich's ambulance company had received a plethora of phone calls in the few days prior to the assassination, and we were discussing the fact that it looked like somebody was timing the arrival of the ambulances to the scene. And just several minutes before JFK's motorcade was to arrive, indeed, there was another emergency call calling Aubrey Reich's ambulance to the scene to pick up an epileptic. What people don't realize is that was precisely at the time when JFK's motorcade was to pass by that area. JFK's motorcade had been held up, time constraints. There was just larger crowds than people anticipated, and the motorcade was 5 minutes late exactly. So Hugh will be telling all these personal live stories, and these are all facts. These are real witnesses
right. That
were right there.
Aubrey Reich has a new book that's coming out. It was written with Colin McSween, who is from Canada. And Colin worked with him for several years to get this beautiful book out, and it will be released also at the conference. And these are things that can be ordered online at jfklancer.com. You can see the new books, and of course you can also order Larry Hancock book, Williams Law's book. Ian Griggs, who is from England and will be
there
speaking at the conference, will be there. And, of course, you can get my forensic DVD so you can have a better understanding about the trajectory analysis that we've talked about.
Which is incredible work. I'm just absolutely astounded. We are speaking with Sherry Feaster right now, and she is a senior crime scene investigator on the phone live from Dallas, where all this took place 1963, 45 years ago. November 22nd, the world changed. It was tantamount, folks, to 9/11. Those of you that are alive right now and going to university and you remember 9/11, you remember where you were. Picture that 45 years ago with JFK, the same thing. There was a commission right after called the Warren Commission. They did an investigation, came out with, they felt that it was Oswald, acted alone. The conspiracy and the cover-up has been going on ever since, despite people like yourself, Sherry, who have done this incredible research. I must say, Larry's work too, Larry Hancock, on all the people that knew about the conspiracy prior to the conspiracy. It's just astounding.
It really is.
I was going to mention also in our pre-production meeting the other night, you had mentioned somebody that showed up at your door that even gave you greater validation for your research and your findings. I was wondering if you recall that conversation and if you would like to talk about that.
I certainly would. I mentioned that I had retired from police work and mm-hmm. was living in Lexington, Kentucky, and was looking for something to do and started looking at trajectory. That's, basically some years after I did the bloodstain pattern analysis. And my husband had made friends and worked with a man who was retired as a military sniper. And he was at our home one evening and had no idea what my background was. As far as he was concerned, I was a housewife. And so he started talking about his life as a sniper because, that was his life work.
Mm-hmm.
And so I told him, what if I would want to kill someone? What if I wanted to shoot? But I want to blame it on somebody else. I don't want for them to be constantly looking for me. I want to make sure somebody else gets the blame for it. He said, well, if you're going to kill someone, if you're going to shoot them, and you want to blame it on someone else, he said, you're going to have to make some plans about, you know, when is the person accessible. And I said, oh, I know I can do it outside because I have a place where I know that they will be and they'll be outside. And so he said, well, you would probably need three people. And so you would put one person that, think of it as a triangle, he said. You put one person at each point. One point would be you shooting the person. Then one point would be the person you want to blame. And then another point would be the distraction. Because when you are a sniper, he said there are four really important things that you have to remember. You have to do one shot, one kill. That's what he said. He said you need to know that you can do the job. You need to know that there's concealment or some way that you are not going to be noticed, that people are not going to see you. You have to be able to get away. And the way that you can do that is you have someone that creates a distraction. Everybody looks that way, and then you shoot, and they don't see you. Or, you know, you can either use a silencer. And in the midst of explaining all of this to me, he suddenly stops and looks at me and says, you're talking about the Kennedy assassination, aren't you?
Oh, man.
I was shocked. Because he had been doing all the talking, not me. And suddenly he said that, and I was, how did you know? He said, we talk. We talk. That's the only thing he said. Never said another thing about it. Wouldn't discuss anymore with me. I was just, got chills from it. I mean, it was just so weird. Well, years later, I had an opportunity to speak with Craig Roberts. Craig Roberts wrote One Shot, One Kill book, the book. He was also a sniper. And, of course, he's done a lot of other things. And one of the things that he's done is come to the conferences. He's been to several of them and spoken there. Well, at the last time I spoke, Craig was not speaking. He was actually in another room, and his wife came to hear me speak. And I did the trajectory analysis. And she went back and she said, Craig, you know, you have to listen to what this girl is saying. Because everybody's up in arms, you know. She's like, it's like the Holy Grail is being sit on. It's not the grassy knoll. It was terrible, you know. People were like, she's, this can't be right. She can't be right.
Sacrilege, so, sacrilege, yeah.
Yes, yes. So he came to me, and I was, I was so excited because I had a planned a tour of the jail where Oswald had been, and I had never been there, and I wanted to go and sit in that jail. I just wanted to see, you know, everything. I wanted to see the spot where Ruby shot him, and you know, so the at the conference, there's opportunity to do that. It's closed to the public now, but through the conference, you can do it.
There you go, folks.
So I was excited about doing that. And then Craig Roberts, who I am like in awe of, comes up to me and says, would you like to go to Dealey Plaza with me? And I'm like, absolutely.
Yeah, twist my arm.
Oh, absolutely. So we go to Dealey Plaza, and he walks on the other side. He walks around, and he looks, and my sister Deborah and a few other people are with us, you know, because obviously he's, you know, a pretty big name, and people are in awe, and so they're like, following him like groupies. And he walks around and he stops at this particular point. Now, Deborah and I had done the same thing with a small group of people a few weeks before.
Okay.
And while we were there, I stopped at a point and said, this is where I think the shooter was locating based upon my trajectory analysis. And I'm taking pictures to put in my presentation.
Okay.
Craig Roberts stops at the exact same spot, turns and says, if I were going to do it, this is where I would have been.
Oh, man.
And Deborah and I look at each other, and it's like, wow. She finally believes me.
And this is a professional sniper.
Yeah, she did believe me. But it was just so nice to have him validate that.
Exactly.
You know,
exactly.
That same spot. So, you know, in what was really good about that was that experience coincided with my analysis. because experience is important.
Absolutely.
Experience says it's a doable shot. Mm-hmm. It's doable. You know, and this is the best place. Well, if it was the best place for him then, it was probably the best place for the shooter in 1963.
Mm, very good point, and wow. Folks, if you're like me, you're sitting here with your jaw wide open going, oh my God, it was a conspiracy. And if that's not enough, it didn't come from the grassy knoll. That was probably just a diversionary shot from the looks of things. And validation from a sniper, a professional sniper. We have about 15 minutes left. I was going to ask you, I'm going to give you your choice, if it's okay with you. Would you like to discuss the Texas School Book Depository and what you found there, or would you like to discuss the Tippit murder and what you found there? I don't think we're going to have time for both, but I could be mistaken. And I will have you back on, don't worry. If you're willing to come back on, young lady, you're here.
I am. I am willing to come back on.
God,
absolutely
love you.
I am. I tell you what I would like to do
is
I'm going to give you one more choice.
Okay.
Okay, I'm going to give you one more choice. Mm-hmm. Because when I first talk to people about what happens when the bullet goes through the body, mm-hmm. I thought maybe we could talk a little bit more about cavitation, because that's what blew the bones out, created the flap, and mm-hmm. disperses the blood.
Yeah, let's do that then. Yeah,
and
absolutely.
You know, if you don't really understand that, you're going to come back later and be saying, I don't get it. How can that work? And I really would like for your listeners to have as many questions answered as possible by the show.
Okay. Just let me set it up. We're speaking with Sherry Feaster. She is a senior crime scene investigator. She's done analysis on the trajectory of the JFK assassination, the bullet shots. What she has found is just blown us completely out of the water, folks. She has found a frontal shot for sure, guaranteed, but not from the grassy knoll where everybody thinks it comes from the opposite side. All her work can be purchased. She's put a DVD together at a fantastic reference website called jfklancer.com. And you can go there. There is a conference coming up November 21st to November 23rd, right in Dallas, where it all took place. They'll take you on special tours, as I've just found out. And I will be making that pilgrimage next year. I can't go this year, but next year I will be making that pilgrimage. I'm going to promise myself. Honey, if you're listening, please. I'll let you buy as many shoes as you want. Just let me go next year. That's a little inside joke between Sherry and I. Sherry, if you wouldn't mind, go ahead. Far away. Thank you.
All right. I just want to take us back to where we were talking about cavitation. It has mm-hmm. to do with what happens when the bullet goes through the head. And remember I said that a bullet goes through in different stages, but it's mm-hmm. so fast. It looks like it's happening all at once, but it's really in stages.
Okay.
So the bullet strikes the skull and creates an entrance hole. Mm-hmm. And as it goes in, it immediately starts creating cavitation. And that cavitation is the pressure that pushes the blood back out of the entry hole as backspatter. And what you see in the Zapruder film is that red mist in front of President Kennedy's head. In fact, it kind of obscures his face in frame 313 of the Zapruder film.
That's right, it does, yeah.
All right, then the bullet continues forward, and it could fragment or tumble or expand as it continues to pass forward. But it, at the same time, it's creating a permanent cavity, which is the hole that the actual solid projectile is creating as it drills through the brain,
mm-hmm.
but also a temporary expanding cavity is created. It is temporary because it expands out and it comes back out, comes back in, as if someone, you know, the balloons that are long and skinny,
mm-hmm, sure,
and you can blow those up,
mm-hmm.
and that's what it looks like. It's like it's around the bullet in. As the bullet travels, so it's like when you blow that balloon, you know how the balloon just kind of goes down and fills
that's
out?
That's right, yeah.
Well, that's what cavitation does. It follows the bullet, and it starts to expand following bullet.
That's a great analogy, by the way. I'm going to use that one, too. Thank you.
You may. Go ahead, right ahead. Just
Thank
remember
you.
Where you got it from. Can you tell I've had to testify a few times?
Just a few.
We need for the jury to understand, and we need for your listeners to understand.
Well, if you can explain it to me, you're doing a great job.
The thing about research, mm-hmm. or I should say about what I do, this kind of research, When you do analysis, the idea is that you should be able to explain it so that the person listening on their own reaches the same conclusions that you have.
Uh-huh.
That's what I want. I don't want you to believe this because you think I'm good at what I do. I don't want you to believe me personally.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want you to just trust because I have a background in forensics that I know what I'm doing. I want you to understand it and say, I understand it, and I think the same thing.
That's a very good point. Very good point.
Okay,
you're a smart woman. Can't say enough about that. You're a smart person, young lady.
Oh, thank you. So as this bullet is passing through, at the same time, mm-hmm. now we have the skull that is fragmented like the cracked egg.
Right.
And we have this pressure that's building up. Imagine if that balloon was inside an egg. It was a little tiny balloon inside the egg. So when it started to blow up, it would push some of that eggshell off.
Of course, yeah.
And some of the egg would come out. And that's what happens with the blood and the tissue. Because the brain cannot be compressed. Water cannot, you can't compress water.
Okay? I see. Okay.
So when the cavity creates, expands out, and it's like a vacuum almost, mm-hmm. when it expands out, it's compressing the brain, which is, has a lot of liquid in it. It cannot be compressed, and it has to go somewhere. Well, if there's an opening, then it's pushed out very forcefully out of that opening. And if it's not, then if there's a crack in the skull, it can push it open so that it can escape.
Uh-huh.
And that's how the bone flap or the pink blob or the evolved mm-hmm. bone, however you want to describe it, that's how that is created.
That's incredible. So that explains everything that we see in the Zapruder film, right down to the bone flap, as you say.
Right.
Yeah.
So, you know, when a bullet strikes the body, the idea is that the energy is transmitted to the tissue. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
That is, when people create bullets, what they talk about takedown power or kill power or, mm-hmm. you know, whatever.
Mm-hmm. No, that's right. Yeah.
That's what they're looking for. Okay? The temporary cavity is much more damaging than the size of the bullet going through. The damage is in the cavitation.
I see. So that's what causes the damage.
Right. So if you don't have cavitation, then it just is an in and out wound. And so there's not a lot of damage. So that's why someone can be shot in, say, the shoulder, and it goes in and out,
mm-hmm.
or the thigh or whatever. Not that they're not injured, but when that energy has a place to go. But if it's in the enclosed head,
yes,
the damage is much more severe.
It's like a minor explosion inside the head.
Exactly. But it's not that it's as an exploding bullet, because you see some people mm-hmm. say, oh, well, it was mm-hmm. an exploding bullet. No, it doesn't have to be an exploding bullet. It just has to be a regular bullet.
Cavitation.
Right, because it's cavitation. And all of this happens in about 5 milliseconds.
Oh, man.
So 5 milliseconds is, that's why it looks like it's immediate.
Yes.
So, and tissue that is as far away as 40 times the diameter of the bullet are stretched and torn and just sheared.
Wow.
So you have this little bitty bullet but 40 times the diameter of the bullet mm-hmm. in 360 degrees in every direction. It's more than just 360. It's like it's the center of that balloon that's opening and going down. So it's in front of it. It's mm-hmm. behind it. It's on every side.
So it's just expanding all the way along that route.
Exactly.
Okay. Yeah,
but
I understand.
Good.
Yeah.
Okay, so, you know, when you really think about what has to happen, and then you think about what was documented by the medical personnel mm-hmm. and what's visible in the Zapruder film and other photographs, it all falls into place.
It certainly does. All the pieces are coming together for me. Absolutely brilliant work. Absolutely incredible. I am sitting
Thank
here.
Thank you.
Unbelievable. We've got to go out and tell Obama that, you know, hello, there's a conspiracy. Do something. Finally, somebody who will listen, I hope. I was going to ask you, what did the Dallas Police Force, what didn't they do that they should have done way back when? Now, I understand it wasn't until 1971 you said that these techniques came into play.
The technique of blood spatter analysis. Yeah, it was not available to them.
Okay.
So they had no clue it even existed. I mean, no one knew it existed. I mean, blood is, from beginning of time, had liquids react to force in a predictable manner.
Okay.
And people had looked at things like blood drops on the floor and said, I can tell the direction that person was traveling. Or they looked at some blood, but the real study of blood and what happens in gunshots and videotaping it and seeing how long it takes to travel and how fast the blood is moving when it leaves the head, and all of those things were not done. They didn't even know it existed to study.
Mm.
Okay? Because it happened so fast. So when would they have seen it in the air?
Exactly. Yeah. Is there anything that you feel they could have done that they did not do? Or maybe were prevented?
It's really difficult to explain the Dallas Police Department. I know that there are people that say, I don't think that they did a good job. And, you know, I think they pretty much worked with what they had. And it wasn't so much that their techniques were poor. They were maybe inconsistent. But I need for people, before you can talk about what they did, people need to understand what it was like to be a Dallas police officer or a police officer anywhere at that time.
Okay, fair enough. That's fair enough. That's
true.
Okay.
Because forensics was a word that wasn't used.
Mm.
People didn't, for them, if you went out with some finger, some powder, and they would have the old brushes and, you know, they would throw black powder on everything. Well, you know, now we know that black powder was probably destroying as many prints as we were picking up. But they didn't know.
Yeah, exactly.
And at that time, having a fingerprint, if you didn't know the person that did it to make the comparison, meant nothing. Because there was no AFIS. AFIS is an automated fingerprint identification system allows not only America, but the world to compare fingerprints and have them in a centralized place.
A database.
A database. But that was not even a dream. Okay? Mm-hmm. So the way that crimes were solved were by confessions and police officers on the street asking questions. In most cases, crimes were committed by people, and they were standing there when the police arrived, the smoking gun. It was a family member or a friend or a worker or something. Very few crimes were solved by using any kind of evidence. It just wasn't done.
Just wasn't done in those days.
Forensics was just a baby. It was just a baby to say, we're going to fingerprint, we're going to collect impression evidence, tires. They were doing it, but they had no way other than in their office to compare it to anything. It was very different. And police officers were men of... A lot of them were big men, and they were the force, you know, and they were short on, I don't want to say that they weren't intellectuals, but that side of police work wasn't as important. So people want to look at the Dallas Police Department and say, well, they should have done this, they should have done that. But, you know, they weren't trained to do this and that.
And that's the difference.
And the times didn't call for this and that. You know, that's not how crimes were solved in those days, doing this and that. So before you really look at the police department and the work that they did in the school book depository, you need to know, number one, what was police work like then? How did you work with other agencies? And, you know, what could you do with your agency? And then, what was it like to to work with the FBI, because I could talk for another hour on that.
And don't worry, I will have you back on, and we shall do
it's
that.
It's very different. Working with the FBI, let me just say, they're a wonderful agency, and, you know, we need them. But they're a one-way street. I don't think they'd be surprised to hear that. They're a one-way street.
Thank you, J. Edgar.
And it can be very frustrating. It can be very frustrating. And, you know, all eyes were on them, and there was a lot of pressure. So I don't know, you know, how to really answer in 15 or 20 minutes even what happened with the Dallas police. I've done the presentation. I've only given it one time. It's on the DVD. If people are interested in it, they can buy the forensic DVD at jfklancer.com. And I hope that they do. And I hope that the listeners, if you have an interest in the Kennedy assassination, there are a couple of things that you really, really need to do. One is you need to be getting the newsletter that JFK Lancer produces. It's an email newsletter. And you sign up for it on the website. On the very front page, or you can sign up on the forum, which is another thing that you need to do. You need to be on the forum. Even if you're just a lurker and you're just watching what everyone else does, you still need to be there, because if you're not, you're going to miss a lot of really important conversation of people who are really serious about this.
Very much so. Good information.
The other thing, the other thing you need to do is you need to attend at least one conference in your lifetime, because you need to see firsthand the people that were there, and you need to hear their stories firsthand. You need to meet the researchers that can answer your questions, your individual question for you, and you need to be able to say thank you to them, because, man, have they paved the way.
Very much so. We're going to have to wrap up now. Sherry, I want to thank you profoundly. I mean, you've blown me away, and I'm sure you've blown my listeners away. Your research is impeccable. Your science is impeccable, and just phenomenal, phenomenal work. I have to congratulate you so much, and I want to thank you very much for coming on the show, and I shall be in touch very soon. Thanks again, Sherry.
Well, thank you. I have enjoyed it very much.
Thank you so much. Tonight, we found out that there was indeed a frontal shot, and it did not come from the grassy knoll. I want to say, to continue your research, please go to jfklancer.com. That's it for me. Thanks so much for listening. You've been listening to Night Fright. I'll see you next week. Thanks, everybody. Thank you, Sherry.
Night Fright, Wednesday nights from 10 to midnight on CKLU 96.7 FM. Your voice in the dark for paranormal and conspiracy radio.